Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
An American lawyer, businessman, and public servant, Clifford Alexander was appointed the first African-American Secretary of the Army by President Jimmy Carter in 1977. His career has focused on improving living and working conditions for minorities and women. He played a role in the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and other civil rights legislation, and helped guide the Army's transition to an all-volunteer force. Mr. Alexander delivered the following lecture, titled Post-Racial: An American Delusion, at Yale Law School on February 4th, 2013.
I want to talk about four different categories. Sort of my own road to equal opportunity. Why I think post-racial is a delusion, and the legal profession and workforce inclusiveness, that is, including minorities in the operations of America. And finally, the American society's indifference to equal opportunity. Let me start with, in 1969, I was chairman of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and President Nixon got me fired. It's one of the great moments of my life, and became part of the Nixon's enemies list. At the time, Dean Thomas worked with me at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. We had hearings in New York and Los Angeles to try and provide greater opportunities for minorities and for women. Ted Kennedy had one of his first public hearings, and in that public hearing, he asked his then friend Cliff Alexander to come testify. And I said, you're going to get me fired. Because along with Ted Kennedy, there was Everett Dirksen. So Everett Dirksen said to me, in his own subtle way, you have been harassing businesses about trying to hire women and minorities. And in my smart ass answer to him, I said, I plead guilty. And then Everett Dirksen said, somebody in this room needs to be fired. Now, it happened to be pretty good coverage of this because it was Ted Kennedy's first hearing. So shortly after that, President Nixon said that he was going to replace the head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And before he had a chance to fully execute that, I, in about 4 months into his administration, charged him with the negative racial stereotypes that he helped to perpetuate. And then I had to get a job. And here I was in Washington. Washington's major law firms had no black people. And one of those law firms, Arlen Porter, made me an offer. The offer was made not because Al Sharpton, who was then 14, picketed the law firm, but because the young white associates made it clear to that partnership that they weren't going to work those ridiculous hours in a lily white place. That's why I got the job. Not because I had noble partners, but because the young white associates put pressure on those partners. So there I went to Arlen Porter to practice law. Now, before doing that, the dean has covered magnificently some of my earlier escapades, but I did want to, again, in telling you how I came to Equal Employment Opportunity, give you just a little more background. My late mother, Edith Alexander, was always a fighter for justice. She headed at one stage the Mayor's Committee for Unity, which was well before there was any enforcement power related to Equal Employment Opportunity. In that time, and during that time, she worked with many wonderful people, including the family of Judge Bramus right here. And they were dear friends, and they worked and I think helped to enhance the opportunities for many people. When there were no laws to be enforced, you sort of had to gum them to death. You had to talk about what it was you were going to do in order to change this society. So my passion certainly for Equal Opportunity came from that. I also credit my old school, the Ethical Fieldston School, for some of that, and other experiences along the line. So when I came to the White House staff, I came with the job of being on the National Security Council staff of McGeorge Bundy's. And at that time, we were in a lot of trouble around the world. After the assassination, I went over to this was in 1963 that I came into the White House. It was our anniversary, July 11th, 1963, we came to Washington with a little child in hand, the poet Elizabeth. And so when we got there, we did, after the awful assassination, I went to work on President Johnson's staff, and we did so much more, I think, in those days for a fair opportunity than any president has come anywhere near it, including this one. But after that passion came, and after we had the White House conference to fulfill these rights, and after we had the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, after we had all of the hearings, we still were in the same position of making some progress, but clearly not enough. And he was my friend at the time, and perhaps the best known fighter for equal employment opportunity in many ways, Martin Luther King, said on April 3rd of 1968 in the Memphis Masonic Temple, "Like anybody, I'd like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want God to do His will, and He will allow me to go up to the mountaintop. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I've not gotten there yet, but I want you to know tonight that we, as a people, will get to the promised land. And so, I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." Well, from this thought and this prayer and this hope, the post-racial promoters reached the startling conclusion with the election of Barack Obama, and that is that somehow we were in post-racial America. That is a clear, clear, clear delusion. Let's look at some of the facts, and only a few of them. Today, as it was 50 years ago, black people are twice as unemployed as white people. Today, a white family net worth is $94,000 in the United States of America. A black family net worth is $7,000 in the United States of America. Today, here at the Yale Law School, a fine lawyer, Tracy Mears, was the first black woman who received tenure at this law school in this very place. Today, at this very place, we can find and we can look around our country and we can see that in terms of poverty, 31% of black youngsters are in poverty. 13% of white youngsters are in poverty. Today, in 2011, in New York City, there were, I want to be sure of this figure, 685,000 people stopped and frisked. 685,000, over 90% of them, people of color. They would have done better finding drugs down on Wall Street in some of the watering holes than doing that to all those people. So, when you look at the sharpest drop in income since 2007, it's of black people in this country. The sharpest drop of income during this period of time. So, let's move on to the next area. And that is law profession, what it does and doesn't do, mostly doesn't do. Here is the American delusion that somehow we're a nation of laws and equity and fairness, etc. Let's look at, first of all, the law itself. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act sets up the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. When it was originally established, it had cease and desist as the way to enforce it. Through the machinations of the Nixon administration, they gutted that law in order to have the entire civil rights action. And that was actually due again to our beloved Senator Everett Dirksen. So what happened? Cynically, they gave a right to sue. Well, when you sue, you're dead before you get your recovery. And what has happened is, because of trial lawyers, mostly, and their lobby, no quick resolution of discrimination cases against minorities or women or the other categories that the EEOC faces, there is no quick way to get it done. These are issues of fact, just as the Labor Relations Board handles issues of fact with cease and desist orders. But somehow, magically here in America, we can't get that done. Because a few lawyers want to make some money, because cynical politicians want to keep it the same way, but certainly there isn't any particular care for the minority worker or the female worker in this society. Let's look at the big law firms in America. Go to any major city, look at any of the statistics, and you'll find less than 2% black partnership. Is this a coincidence? No. It is racism, it's racial discrimination. If you want to call it anything else, you're wrong. It is either racism overt or covert, but that is what it is. Now, until the society, and particularly lawyers, who are supposed to be intelligent people, start to address these issues as they address other issues by some analysis of what it is, you have to say first, what is the problem? The problem is racism. Now, racism isn't me calling anybody in this room a racist or vice versa. Racism has to do with how a society looks at categories of people. And in this case, it's how they look at black people. And when they look at black people in terms of employment opportunities, it is generally negative. And one has to, quote unquote, prove themselves. Now again, let's look at the big law firms. At the big law firms, very often, if a minority gets in the door, he or she has the opportunity to work with the government, not necessarily with the major commerce parts of the society, not with the pharmaceutical companies or the oil companies, because somehow, the client might not like to see that black face. Who changes that? How should this change? You have to first accept the fact that there is racism. Then, after you've accepted that fact, you need to figure out what are the ways to challenge it. And you can call it whatever you want to call it, but that really is the only way it's going to be done. Now again, we're in 2013. And again, I will repeat to you, less than 2% of the lawyers as partners in major law firms, go to Philadelphia, Washington, New York, whatever it may be, are black. That, my friends, is no coincidence. Now, let us also look at the highest court in the land. You're not going to find much help in the narrow-minded majority of the Supreme Court who exercise bias with a pen. The court is a lesser place for fairness and more an activist organization for the preservation of certain rights of those in power. Hear me again. I came here and I learned that you found out the ultimate law at the Supreme Court. Anybody in this room who can wake up in the morning can tell you what the justices are going to do. That's what is the system we're living in today. You know what Roberts is going to do. You know what Scalia is going to do. You know what Thomas is going to do. You know what Alito is going to do. So you pray for the day that somehow somebody else will be there and will vote for equity and fairness. Not for something that is wrong, but for what courts ought to do. So it isn't the way I was taught here that you get the law out of the Supreme Court. what you get out of the Supreme Court is bias through a pen. Hear me loud and clear. That's what you get. And to kid yourself about anything else, I think, is absolutely dead wrong. Now, let's go back to law firms. Your president in waiting, Peter Solovey, when he accepted his position, he set out four goals. They were innovative, accessible, unified, and excellent. Those were goals for this university, and they were very fine goals. And what indeed did he do? He explained what he meant by those goals. And think if we superimpose those on law firms. But let me just tell you what he said in one of them. And finally, excellence in some ways is easier to define and harder to achieve. We should always ask ourselves, as we think about our new programs, new opportunities, is this an activity that either will be excellent, can be excellent, or would enhance the excellence of something else that we're doing? Wouldn't it be nice if law firms thought about accessibility? Wouldn't it be nice if they thought about being innovative? Wouldn't it be nice if they didn't use the term unified? Wouldn't it be nice if excellence wasn't their goal? So, when we look at our society today, we have the last president who really worked hard for inclusiveness was Lyndon Johnson. We have no major power cluster in the American society that places workforce inclusiveness as their primary goal. Have you ever seen a white businessman of one of the Fortune 500 or businesswoman say, today, my corporation will set the tone about bringing in minorities and women and elevating them? No. Have you ever seen the head of a major law school say, today, I will see to it that those who come to my law school will see to it that they exercise full inclusiveness and that my faculty will bear some relationship to what ought to be fair in America? No, you won't see that at all either. Would you see in today's media any attention given to this? You'll get much more about Groundhog Day than you will about this. So if you look at educational institutions, you look at governmental institutions, you look all around the place, nobody's got a voice except to say, my, look how far we've come. Slavery was just around the corner, and look at these pickaninnies. They're doing just fine right now. They're doing just fine. There's Michael Jordan, and there's Oprah, and there's Ken Chanel, and you know, they're doing just fine. But by the way, in the Fortune 500, only five of those Fortune 500 CEOs are black people. That's all there is. And by the way, let's look at the US Senate. Another leading indicator in American society. In the history of this country, there have been three black people elected to the US Senate. Three, that's it. Don't tell me about the two in Reconstruction because one of them was appointed and the other one was elected by a legislature. Don't tell me about the two that are now appointees. Don't tell me about the one who succeeded Barack Obama. The only ones are Barack Obama, a lady who preceded, not him specifically, from Illinois, and a man from Massachusetts. And only the man from Massachusetts lasted more than one term. That's it in the leading legislative body of America today. Now, I'd like to take the privilege that you get from standing here and you all having to listen to me to give some general advice to black people. But so you won't think that what I give advice to is all-encompassing or that I am the sole leader of black nation, I'd like to quote the finest poet in America. You can guess her name. it's a poem called Today's News. And she said, I didn't want to write a poem that said, blackness is, because we know better than anyone that we are not one or 10 or 10,000 things. Not one poem, we could count ourselves forever and never agree on the number. When the first black Olympian gymnast was black and on TV, I called home to say it was colored on Channel 3 in 1988. Most mornings these days, Ralph Edwards comes into the bedroom and says, Elizabeth, this is your life. Get up and look for color. Look for color everywhere. Now, the advice I'm going to tell and give to all of my black friends and some of you who aren't, at no time should you be thankful to white people for whatever progress black people have made. In a democratic society, that is what you ought to get, what you can provide. It was not given to you by the white nation. It should not be given to you by the white nation. If they ask you to be grateful, thumb your nose at them. Be clear that the only people you need to be thankful to are your family and your friends. You are not thankful, as some may tell you, look how much progress we've made. Aren't you glad? Aren't you happy? Not all of us have a jump shot, so we're not necessarily going to make that kind of money. But more importantly, in this form of society, in this society that is allegedly a democratic society, we should be judged according to the ability that we provide for others, and not just because a society that has a majority of white people sees some quote-unquote progress. Now, let me talk somewhat specifically about this place. In May, on May 25th of 1962, it was a lovely day, and Elizabeth and Adele and I were there, and Mark Alexander was graduating from the Yale Law School. The dean, Vito Calabresi, introduced a distinguished guest who sat behind him on the stage. Guido indicated that the honored guest had requested not to speak. She had graduated with the class of 1922. But one of the few people who didn't obey Guido, she got up and she said the following. When I came to Yale Law School, they said to me, we do not take women. I told them, you better begin now. That should be our slogan about really working for workforce inclusiveness in that society, in this society. I have been infected with a television series, Breaking Bad. Some of you may know. And yeah. This shows I'm hip, you know. And Vince Gilligan, who was the originator of this, said, what is the definition of Breaking Bad? And it is to raise hell. That's what Breaking Bad is. We need to raise hell in this society about the singular lack of inclusiveness. So if you want to take those two things together, raise some hell, and we need to begin now. And maybe the next speaker, some years from now, will see a better place for all of us. Thank you for all your time.